Good morning. Let's see. I have so much exciting, fun things to do today. Let's start with some introductions. All right. My name is Jessica Owley. The computer system doesn't seem to think that's my name. It sometimes calls me Jessica Owley Owley. Sometimes it calls me Jessica Owley Lippman. Sometimes Lippman. Ignore all that. It's Owley. If you email Lippman, you'll actually get my husband, who's an engineering professor. He cannot help you. I'm up on the 7th floor, and my office hours, I looked at your schedule, so my impression is that generally this is the schedule, those are times that you guys can make my office hours. I teach 3 classes this semester, which means I'm busy, but when I am not physically in class, I am usually in my office. I'm one of the few professors that's just here every day working away. So come on upstairs anytime and try and find me. It's easy to find my office. It's covered with drawings by children and law students. My secretary is a little awkward right now, which is that she's not awkward. The situation is awkward. All 3 of my secretaries are lovely women. My secretary is actually out on a medical leave right now, and so I have 2 secretaries who are it is going to only become an issue in this class because you've seen by looking at the syllabus, I do my class a little bit different than kind of a typical big 1L class in that I have a lot of assignments along the way. So it means that you guys might actually interact more with my secretary than you probably have with some of the others because of just kind of turning in assignments and picking things up from her. So right now we'll say that my secretary is a woman named Sandy in 717. On alternate days of the week, it's actually a woman named Sue on the 5th floor. But I think we can mostly stick with Sandy going to 717 if you need anything. It's also helpful because it's the same floor I'm on, so if there's nobody in 717, walk on down and see if I can help you a few doors down. Computer policy. Dun, 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 dun. Thumbs down. Sorry. This is just something I know that there will be like 10 of you in this room that hate me forever for it, but I've just learned that the class goes better when we close our computers. People seem to absorb the material better when we close our computers, and I can see all your beautiful faces. Oh, I see another sneaky one back there. My computer policy extends to those of you who think I cannot see you texting underneath the desk. These are not like full-on desks. So you realize that I can see it when you are texting to me. Please don't do that. It's really distracts me, too. I start to like totally lose, and it's not hard to distract me to learn. All right. As a slight recompense for taking away your computers, I do audio record every single class. So to the extent that you're kind of frantic and not thinking you are going to be able to type fast enough or maybe you miss something, all of the recordings are available immediately after class. The website will be set up today after the first class. The AV people set up the website for me, so I will email it out to you. I also, on that same website, will put up my PowerPoints for you. One of the things I do on the PowerPoint slides, these numbers are a little tiny, but you can see that there's like a little number at the bottom. The slides are number 2, so that could help you in taking your notes. You can be like, oh, that was slide number 2. I have questions on whatever. If you guys have other ideas of things that you might find helpful, let me know. Everyone always asks for the slides ahead of time. I am literally making the slides until like 8:55. So and half the time they have like answers on them. So I will give them to you right after class, but before class is the one thing I can't quite seem to do. If anyone needs accommodations, and you probably know who you are for note taking or things like that, and the computer is a problem, just go talk to Dean Saram about that, and or one of my secretaries that you might be able to find, and they can help you figure those things out. Okay. All right. Let's see. Anything else? Oh, Facebook page. So I did this last year, and people seemed to like it. We created a group on Facebook. This is not at all mandatory if you're a Facebook hater, like, or if it just distracts you too much, forget about it. But it is a good place people found to kind of ask little discussion questions. Sometimes I put up sample hypos. Sometimes people show something interesting they found in the news. Sometimes people have used it to find study groups, things like that. So it's kind of as useful as we make it. But if you're not into it, just ignore it. Anything else? Anything else we need to know? So I do have assignments throughout the semester.
Some of the assignments we'll do in class, and some of them will be take-home. If they're take-home, I'll always give you at least 10 days ahead of time to work on it. And to the extent that I can, I make them blind graded, which we'll figure out when it comes. Usually that means you email them to my secretary and she puts a number on them. When it's a like in-class role play, then they're not blind graded and we'll figure it out from there. Look at those dates now. If you know one of those dates is your sister's wedding, which awkward of her to get married on a Wednesday, but you know, let's figure that out now and let me try and do those. The earlier you can tell me if you know you're going to really miss something, and obviously for like really good reasons, because to reschedule them is very tricky, particularly because a lot of them involve you working with a group or doing a role play or something, and it's really weird to play four parts on your own and talk to yourself. So let me know as soon as you can if you see anything like that. All right. I feel like I talked about everything on the syllabus. Does anybody have questions about the outline of the course? Everybody found a book. How many people bought a brand new spanking book? Really? Okay. All right. All right, I'm just mad. I'm mad at the price of law school books. It's ridiculous. It's ridiculous. Like, I was mad when I went to law school when they were $100, and when I found out that they're now, some of them are $300, right? Is anybody paying more than $300 for a book?
Not yet.
I'm like, what the hell? Yeah, and especially this one, there's like, it's a new version. They've updated a few things, but very little. As you can see, even from the page numbers, there's only a couple cases that we're going to have to, those of you who bought the old book, or there's like two cases we'll have to kind of track down for you guys to read. I guess if you bought the new book, it will be much easier for you to resell yours, but do what we can. And then everybody also found the little tiny supplemental book easily. Okay, good. We won't be using that for we won't be using it the first week at all, but we'll come up to that soon. Okay. Let's see. Oh. That seemed like, what did I do? Oh, all right. We'll come to this then. Let's see if this works. Okay. This is something that if you take any class, I do this to all my students in all my classes. People get tired of it if they're on their fifth class with me. But I would like you guys to fill out, take an index card, ask you their own, and fill out this information for me. I will warn you that I might use this information against you. This is not the place to confess and like secret aspects of your personality that you don't want your classmates to find out. I'm not saying I'm going to stand up and read that, but it has been known that I reveal things that are on the cards in conversation. So, yeah. All right, there's cards. Maybe I'll start up here somewhere. Alright, I'll leave it up there for a little while. I'm also going to pass around a seating chart. It takes me a couple weeks to learn everyone's name, so it is really just a seating chart for that. Feel free to move around. What's the difference in your name? Enough cards? Everybody get some?
Let's see. Let me, I feel like it is only fair I will answer these questions for you, from my perspective. My full name, we already know that, just got it. You may call me whatever you like, except for Jennifer. I hate it when people call me Jennifer. It's not, it's a thing that happens to everybody named Jessica. I just call Jennifer. You can call me Jessica, you can call me Professor Owley, you can call me whatever. My hometown, I'm from Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Comes out sometimes in embarrassing words that I say, or in my love of the Packers. I went to Wellesley College and studied physics, which obviously has come in really handy. It does, right? It also just shows you that actually I think kind of diverse undergraduate degrees are often more helpful for law than people who did kind of pre-law things, although... Well, I'll get up to speed even if you did pre-law. Come on. Graduate degree. I do obviously have a law degree, but I have a couple more as well. For those of you who are did not know this, I'm one of the core environmental law faculty, so I have a lot of environmental degrees as well, and have a PhD in that. Interesting jobs. I thought being a lawyer was pretty cool. I used to be a lawyer in San Francisco. I studied environmental and land use law at a big firm there. I've also cleaned bathrooms for a living, so there's a spectrum for you. And hobbies. I'm an obsessive knitter, and that's not that interesting. I have two children. They keep me busy. They're this sizes. My favorite movie is Apocalypse Now, probably, which is, you know, bright and cheerful. I'm also a big Lebowski fan. Let's see. So the next thing I want to do, while some of you guys are still kind of the seating chairs coming around, maybe you're answering a few of those last questions, is... Pop quiz.
No. As an environmental professor, I just want to see how much paper I can get out of first day.
Some of these. What are some of the things that you thought of when you heard the word property? Yeah.
possession. Okay? As in, to have possessions now?
The property
brothers. The property brothers? What was this thing? I don't know.
It's a great show.
Oh, my God. Oh, what are they doing? Do they, like, flip houses or something?
Yeah.
Is it the one with vanilla ice?
No.
No. Okay, all right, so property brothers. Okay, but that's definitely a real estate thing, right? So when they say property, that I assume that seems to be about, like, houses and real estate. Yeah.
Land.
All right. Yeah.
Landlord.
Yeah.
Ownership.
Nice.
Taxes.
Oh, you're nodding at taxes.
Police.
Sale. All right, so far, you guys, I feel like a lot of very kind of real estate land-based terms. Is that another hand here?
Transfer.
Oh, wow, very. I have to say, like, the first time I had the word property, transfer came to mind. Yeah.
Value.
Intellectual. Okay. All right, so we see kind of a wide variety. Nobody has kind of said one of the most common terms I hear. I saw another hand over here. No? I was imagining. All right, yeah, in the back.
Private.
Okay, and behind you?
Right.
All right, so would you guys have made that same list before you did the homework, do you think? Or do you think that reading about property influenced a little bit, like, the words you put down here? What did you guys think this class would be about before you had gotten the syllabus or the textbook? When you just were handed your schedule and had the word property on it, what did you think you'd be learning? What did you think?
It said estate planning.
Estate planning? Yeah?
Real estate?
No. Sorry. Anything else? Nothing else came to mind? You're like, I have no idea what's going to happen in that room. Yeah.
Investment.
Maybe, in some ways. Anything else you guys thought? You thought, like, oh, when your parents are like, oh, I see you've got property. What are you going to learn in that class?
More like the history of it, like how it came to be.
The history of property. We will talk about that. I'm impressed that you kind of thought that and looking at the word. I have to admit, when I was in law school and I was handed my schedule, property was actually my very first class, I could not figure out what it was going to be about. You know, when people are like, oh, what property? What are you studying that? I was like, I have no idea. I have no idea what it was going to be. I guess I thought real estate transactions or leases or maybe landlord-tenant. And it is some of those things. It is some of those things. But it's a lot more. It's a lot more. And you see that a little bit in our reading today, but you'll see that as the class goes on. One other thing that we do differently here compared to how they study property in other countries is in other countries, there's one class that is land property and another class that, what we would call real property, like real estate, and another class that is personal property, like things. So nobody said things or stuff. That's often one of the words that people think of for property. They think of, like, my stuff. So not just the land you own, but, you know, your computer, your clothes, your, you know, video games, your stuff being your property. My 6-year-old has a very firm sense of what is her property and what is the 4-year-old's property, and they do not own land yet. So so we don't divide it up. So we will actually talk about both personal property and real property. I don't think we'll get to intellectual property just for sake of time, and because the intellectual property professors told me I'm stepping on their toes when I cover intellectual property, and they much prefer you to take intellectual property with them than to have me mislead you, I guess. But that is a big part of property, and we'll talk a little bit about that today with our Vanna White case. There are some people, including professors at this school, that find property to be kind of one of the hardest classes to get their brain around because of trying to figure out exactly what it should encompass. Like, what are we throwing together there? Because it's just a bunch of different rules regarding all the stuff we own. And we can see that we already cover some of the things that we could think about as property in other classes. Okay, so criminal law, you are taking this semester? So some of you have Bukai, and some have Binder? Okay, Binder. It's Binder. It's the turn now. Okay, Bukai and Binder. Okay, so I'd have to look at their syllabi, but I'm guessing you're going to learn some property crimes. You're going to learn about things like theft,
right? You're going to learn about kind of damage to property. Those are, so in criminal law, we cover things that are property. What about torts? Last semester? With who? Engel? Everybody had Engel? Ewing. Oh, I forgot he's teaching torts.
I like to check everybody's syllabus to see what you guys have learned. Did you, in your torts class, learn about any property crimes? Which ones? Conversion? Trespass? Did you do nuisance? Everybody did nuisance?
Okay.
Did Ewing do nuisance?
Yes.
Did Engel do nuisance?
No.
No, okay, all right. Okay, so you're already seeing, those are very standard property torts as well. So contracts is now, right? Tausig and Wooten? Okay, so contracts also sometimes is very, we'll see, oh, as this class goes on, we get it very close sometimes to a contract. Think about landlord-tenant, right? It's definitely rules about property, but that lease agreement looks a lot like a contract, and we might have to call on some contract terms to interpret that. You all had Kanar for con law, is that right?
Yes.
Did you cover the Fifth Amendment?
No.
All right. We'll do it in here then. We'll do it in here. So the Fifth Amendment is all about property. It's, you know, eminent domain, takings law. Those phrases sound familiar. There's a big part of constitutional law that is about protecting property. So actually, property then is a subject that comes into play in all of the different classes that you take and all of the different areas of law. So it becomes kind of an interesting thing to figure out what do we pull together then and put in this property class. Property textbooks are written from the standpoint that most schools used to, and many still do, have property as a required two-semester class that's taught, three units and three units. That's why there's actually more in your textbook than we'll be able to cover. There's whole chapters you're just going to have to set aside for sake of this being a four-unit and not a six-unit class. But a lot of the things that we'll talk about will start about kind of what it means to figure out who owns things and what the rules around ownership should be. And how do we determine what those are? How do they change over time? And we will do things like landlord-tenant, and we will do some things that are kind of related to estates and trusts and stuff like that. But it's not kind of... it's usually not exactly what people expect when they see the word property. It's actually more fun than it sounds. It was indeed, of course, my favorite class of law school. All right, let's see. Did you define property differently when you were talking about a kid versus a 45-year-old? No, I mean, some people don't. Some people are like, I talk to my children like they are 45 already. What were some of the, if you had to tell somebody what property was, what would you say?
Yeah. I put like a little 3-year-old in context of like a teddy bear, saying like this, you own this teddy bear, so it's something that you own.
Yeah, but what does that mean when you, okay, so the kid says, okay, I own the teddy bear, what does that mean?
That it's yours, that you have, I don't know, it's hard to like use bigger terms to explain to a 3-year-old, so that's why I was trying to like use like a little teddy bear to, you know, show ownership.
Right, but I think to show ownership, we have to explain to them what it would mean for them to own it, right? So yeah. So it's you're getting there, but it's like we have to go. They're going to be like, why, right? Yeah.
I used a toy too, and I said you can play with it by yourself, give somebody else permission to play with it, or join it through.
Okay, so what you're starting to put in there is the idea that the person with ownership, the child, gets to make the rules regarding that item. Yeah.
I said anything that belongs to you because a family member gave it to you or because you earned it with your money.
Okay, so I think that we have to put them together, though. I think you guys are both right. It's something that belongs to you. It's interesting. You talk about how they acquired it. How did it become theirs? And she tells us what is the need for it to be theirs. Those are all the types of things, the types of rules we'll talk about in property. Both how did it become somebody's, and then what does it mean once we say it's theirs? Those are kind of two kind of key aspects that come up in a lot of our property discussions. Anything else? Did you get more complicated for the 45-year-old?
Yes.
What did you say there?
I said like it involves a variety of components, the largest of which is possession, like the right to possess or own something. So I assume that...
Yes, I think we can now assume the other thing.
So you can use like more terminology as a property expert.
Okay, so what did you tell them other than possession?
And then I talked about private property versus public property and like, you know, different things like that. know, something that's public is for society's benefit as a whole, and, you know, private property, you have the right to, and you can transfer or sell it, you know, contributes to your wealth, things like that.
Okay, yeah, so good components. Well, some places would even suggest that public property doesn't even deserve the label property, that we should reserve that title for things that are private, and kind of having a private connotation to it. We don't use that in the United States, but there are some countries that talk about it different. Did you were there any things on this list that you thought could not be considered property? Anything on there that you wouldn't say was property? Yeah.
Baby?
The baby is not property?
Yeah.
Anything else?
Okay. A song.
The song is not property?
Well, you don't own the song. It's like...
So it's not ownable?
Well, like, you have a right to use it and play it, but you don't really own the actual song.
What if you're the one who wrote the song?
Then you own it.
Then you own it. Okay.
Facebook post or tweet? There's probably something in the user license agreement that says Facebook owns all your tweets.
Okay, so that would make it
property.
Because that's interesting. You're saying maybe you don't own it, but it's not saying it's not property, right? So if Facebook says I have ownership of all your posts, or Twitter has something that says I own all your tweets, do you think they could do that? Do you think they could declare ownership of all those things? Yeah, I was like, of course they can. This is I do think it's interesting as time goes on in discussing these things, people become much more kind of accepting of this idea that they would own this stuff, right? I think a couple of, like, 5 years ago, people would be outraged at the idea that Facebook owned their post or that Twitter owned their tweets. And now I think we're kind of like, yeah, we're so used to the fact that everything seems to belong to Zuckerberg, you know, so... So, or Google, right? Like, Google kind of somehow owns probably my children. But I think that is a kind of, in some ways, a controversial idea. It's my thought. It's a freedom of expression. Is it something that anyone should be able to own? A kind of a thought floating out in the ether? Does it matter what that post contains? What if it contains kind of, a quote from somebody is quite different from kind of an original haiku I might write and post on Twitter? Maybe I would feel more ownership of that as kind of me, more akin to the song I wrote, right? So it gets pretty tricky, and there actually are kind of debates and cases now about what Facebook owns and what Twitter owns and some of these, you know, Instagram and stuff like that. At what point are they, are you kind of giving up ownership of these things to them? But no point are people really arguing about the idea of whether it's property. They kind of accept that these are the things that you could buy and sell and transfer and create rules about of reproducing them or excluding people from them, which shows you also that new forms of property kind of can emerge all the time, right? We can kind of create something new that we create that is a property in. There's, I think lay people tend to think about property a little bit differently than lawyers do. Right, I think that we, or particularly law scholars, right, we tend to think of property more in terms of rules and rights than actual physical stuff. So if you ask somebody what property is on the street, they're most likely to say actually a physical thing, like land, a house, a computer. And if you ask a lawyer, right, a lot of you were already coming up with these things like rights and transfer, right? The idea that there was something kind of about the rules regarding property that was beyond just the physical, tangible elements of property. One really common way of people thinking about property is thinking about it as the rights you have against other people. So this comes up with the kid, right? What is the kid's... the kid has the rights that are with relation to everybody else, and they can make the rules regarding them. But these rights are not unlimited. Let's take the example of a car. So, what rights do you have when you own a car? What do you get to do with your car?
Drive it wherever you want.
Drive it wherever you want?
Well... Oh, you mean like on the grass, or like?
Yeah.
I meant like distance-wise, like
distance. However far you want, you can put whatever mileage on it you want to.
Yeah, on the street, of course.
On the street, of course. Okay. What else can you do with your car? Yeah.
You can sell your car.
You could sell your car.
can modify your car.
You could modify your car. You could pimp your ride. You could lend it to somebody. Yeah.
You could lock away in your garage and leave it there forever.
You could just, you know, keep it locked away and just let nobody uses it, but you just have kind of satisfaction from owning it, I guess. Looking at it, sure.
You could live in it.
Anything else? You could give it away, not just borrow it or sell it, but just say, like, give it to somebody. Could you destroy it? Could you, you know, just take a sledgehammer to your car and destroy it? Would you be breaking any law by doing that?
Yeah, so a right to destroy, we'll see, is an important kind of element in thinking about property. So you can drive your car, you give it away, you can transfer it in different ways, you could use it for non-car purposes, perhaps, like living in it. You can prevent other people from using your car. But it's not limitless what you can do with your car. What are some of the restrictions on what you could do with your car?
You can't hurt other people.
You can't hurt other people with it. You can't drive it down the sidewalk, and you can't drive it into a crowd. Anything else?
You're not allowed to drive it over the speed limit.
You're not allowed to drive it over the speed limit. You're not supposed to drive it over the speed limit, right? There's other traffic rules we have beyond the speed limits, right? You're supposed to stop at stop signs. You're supposed to kind of obey the other rules of traffic. Anything else? There's limits to how much you can modify your car, right? We might have, in particular, for example, rules about your exhaust, right? So you can't modify it so that we take your cleaners off the exhaust pipes and take out your catalytic converter, or whatever they're called.
Yeah, you're not supposed to drive it without registering it and getting insurance.
Right, so we could maybe just park it in our garage, but you can't even park it on the streets in New York without having a registered and gotten certain insurance, getting licenses, all those types of things. Yeah?
You can't drive it while under the influence.
Can't drive it while under the influence. We have a lot of rules, actually, about this piece of property that we say you have a lot of power over, but we actually, it's not a limitless power. There's a lot of rules we make about it.
Yeah.
You can on private property. So we can see how there might be different rules about that, right? But we also like the same idea that you can have an unregistered car on private property, but the second you put it on the street, it's different. We create rules regarding our property that people do not, nobody's kind of outraged by that, right? Nobody's totally like up in arms about the fact that we have rules of the road, that we have rules about, well, whether or not you can drive under the influence. We might have rules about whether or not you can live in your car. That's not permitted everywhere. So we create rules regarding our property. So you can't give it to a minor. You can't drive it when you're 14, you know? So those are all kind of rules we have regarding property that we seem to feel are genuinely acceptable rules. And this is true for almost all types of property we'll talk about. You have all of these things that are your rights associated with that, but it's always limited. There's no property right, no type of property we have in the United States that it's a limitless right that you can do with it whatever you want. All of them have some rules bound up in them. Okay, one of the things we talk about in property is trying to figure out, which we mentioned, somebody was talking about it with the kid, how did you get that teddy bear? Like, what made it become yours? So we can also think about this in terms of the car and who owns the car. And we can think about who we think, or what we think is the best way to determine who should own the car, if that makes sense. All right, so how do we generally figure out, how do you generally become the owner of a car?
You buy it.
You buy it. That's the most common way that people become car owners. They purchase them with money. Other ways people become car owners?
A gift,
right? So these are the most common ones, right? Either you purchase it or somebody gives it to you. This becomes a way of distributing property. It becomes a market-based system for distributing property based on who kind of has the money usually to pay for it. And we can kind of put aside the gift because that's also probably tied up in kind of the still kind of your financial resources available to you. But we could determine ownership different ways. We could instead think about some of the different theories of property we read about and decide that those are good bases for determining ownership. And we'll get into them in a little bit more detail, but if you think about first possession, we could say whoever saw that car first gets it. So the person who saw the car first is the person who owns it. A little tricky with cars. What about the person who needs it most? Maybe we actually take a distributive justice approach to cars in society and we figure it out. Like, what if I had a car that I was going to give to one of you and we want to decide what was the best way for me to determine who should get the car? What do you guys think would be the fairest way for us to do that, or the best way to do that? I'm going to give somebody a car. How should I determine which of you gets the car?
First, I'd say you should give it to me. But then I would say whoever is least likely to be able to obtain one if you did not.
Okay. All right. So whoever is like not going to be able to get a car for other means, the most perhaps the most needy of a car. Right. That's not even exactly the right word. The person who is least likely to have a car is the one who I should give a car to. Otherwise, we might decide this.
Like how much they rely on that.
So that's more the needy one. Like, maybe we could figure out how far you guys are commuting from, what you need to do, is there a bus available, do you have a bicycle, and figure out who actually thinks needs the car the most. Any other things?
Just at random.
Just at random. I could just do a lottery. I could just pick names out of a hat. Anything else?
Whoever will do the best with it.
Whoever does the best things with it. Maybe if I give you the car, you are going to agree to, like, drive your classmates places they need to go. Maybe you're going to do meals on wheels and bring food to people. Maybe we actually think that society will be the best off if we give that person the car. Anything else we might do?
Like a reward for just being awesome?
A reward for being awesome? Whoever gets the top grade in the class, forget that Cali Award thing. You get a car. Right, so we can think whoever is the nicest. So we can think of like actually different ways that we distribute property. And in the United States, for the most part, it has evolved to the point where it was just market based. But it didn't start off that way, and it isn't that way in all other countries, right? So distribution of property a lot of times could be based upon who we think is going to use that property the best. It could be based upon what we think is going to be the best for society. It could be based on who's most needing of it. Who has never had a car before and it would be their first opportunity to have a car. And we see those ideas of equality, distributive justice, still in our cases as the judges are trying to figure out what are some of the best property rules. They still, even in our market-based system, don't always say, like, let's just say whoever can buy it out. They'll think about some of these other rules as what is going to be the best for everyone. Michael Sandel is a Harvard professor, and he wrote this book that is called What Money Can't Buy. And I'll put some of these examples on the Facebook page. He also suggested that there's some types of things that we should never allow to be property, that it become property. Things that it feels wrong that we just allow to be in a market-based system. One of his examples is standing in line. The example I think he uses is the Shakespeare tickets. So Shakespeare in the Park in New York City is always supposed to be free, right? You're not supposed to ever be able to pay for tickets. That's the idea, is that everybody gets to go. And, they have really big names, and it's supposed to be a wonderful thing. And you just have to stand in line for hours to do it. But one of the things that happens is that wealthier people pay people who have made this their job to go stand in line. So there's professional line standers who will then stand in line for you all day, and you just pay them $50, and then you get your tickets to Shakespeare. And then you would say everybody's the winner here in some ways. In some analyses, you would say everybody's the winner because this person got money they wouldn't have gotten, and this person got to see a play they really wanted to play and that they obviously valued more than the person who really preferred the $50. Well, Sandel argues that this is somehow still, like, gives us the creeps. Like, we still somehow feel bad that happened. Like, not everyone, but some people would feel like it just so doesn't feel fair. It's a type of thing we shouldn't be able to buy and sell. It shouldn't be a thing that we could have a property in, like line standing. Here's a couple other examples. Line standing, isn't there some, like, famous barbecue? Does anyone know what I'm talking about? There's, like, this famous barbecue place in Texas and Nobody knows who I'm talking about. No, okay. God, I gotta remember who it is. It's like Kanye, I think, tries to like skip the line, and everybody's like, you gotta, you're 2 hour wait now to get back there. So it was a, so there was kind of this egalitarian feeling to it. There's a few other weird things that you can buy that we could think about whether or not it's appropriate to buy. You can actually pay to upgrade your prison cell in some places. So you can pay, I can't remember what it was, I think it's like $90 a day to actually, in some county in California where you actually get a nice, clean, private prison cell. There's some places that pay, there's some school districts that pay kids to do their homework. You know, they get like $2 for every book they read in Atlanta, I think, to try and promote book reading. And some of these things feel like things that shouldn't be part of the market. They feel like things that shouldn't be things that we're creating property rights in, that we're marketizing. Yeah.
I always think about this example in macroeconomics class. And the professor was telling us like a disaster after that happens when they have to give water to people. Mm-hmm. That it's actually, you know, under the paradigm that we were using, doing the graphs and everything, it was more efficient to charge people for water instead of having them stand in line for it and use, like, a justification, like a market justification for why, like, poor people should essentially have to not have water when other people can pay for it. And it was, like, more economically efficient.
Which I think is part of actually kind of what Sandel's saying in some ways, is that we can actually look at these things like the Shakespeare chain line that is economically efficient. It makes way more sense. Particularly perhaps if that person who's paying the $50 was actually going to make $100 that day while they were working, it makes a lot of sense for them to pay $50 to the person who's going to make $10 that day, something like that. We can actually figure out economic efficiency, and we'll see that economic efficiency and utilitarian approaches, which often use economics as a proxy, often lead to an answer that we still don't just feel right about. We still feel like there's something missing there in terms of justice or equality. And so that's why we see that there's multiple theories of property, and judges will often call upon all of them. Or whichever one's going to get the answer they like. We'll see that too. But you know that the utilitarian approach is just one, because there's sometimes we just don't feel like it works out right for property.
I have no idea what I have on my slides. Let's see if I remember. Oh, there's the car that's the car I was going to give you guys. Okay, definitions of property. I'm going to give you I wanted to just talk about two really famous definitions of property that I think come later in your book, but I just wanted to mention them earlier. One is from Blackstone. Have you guys come across Blackstone in other classes? So Blackstone is, you know, this English jurist from the 1600s who is a really big figure, particularly in property. And he writes kind of the first big property treatise, and you'll see people kind of all the time talking about Blackstonian versions of property and stuff like that. Oh, it's like not in focus, huh? They're both a little out of focus? Mm-hmm. That's annoying. Okay, this is so you can tell he's writing in the 1600s almost by the language he chooses. The sole and despotic dominion which one man claims and exercises of external things in the world, in total exclusion of the right of any other individual or universe. So there's a couple things that echo throughout the course on the Blackstonian vision. One is kind of this despotic dominion, the idea that you as a landowner or you as a property owner really get to act like a tyrant. So you get to make the rules and you get to keep people up. And the other thing we'll see come up as we start talking next week about the different rights related to property, or next class I should say, is the idea of exclusion. So excluding others being the number, kind of the almost the strongest aspect of the rights of being a property owner, is your ability to exclude others from that. We'll see that that's only kind of one of your rights. We've already kind of talked about other rights like transferring and destroying. But a lot of people still identify that as feeling like the most important definition of a property right, what you can exclude people from. Hofield talks about this idea of property as in it's rights related to a thing, that they're not rights related to a thing. They're really rights that it's really about the relationship between people. So we should think about rights more about what are our relationships with each other with regards to that thing, as opposed to what is my relationship to that thing. It's really about how do we react to each other, how do we interact regarding external things, not how do we interact with that thing. And his idea of rights is that property is kind of a bundle of rights, sometimes called a bundle of sticks, that people have against one another, that I have different rights, that I hold these rights in the car, my right to transfer it, my right to destroy it, my right to use it. But maybe you have also rights related to that and the rights to be free from me hurting you with it, stuff like that. Now this course focuses on private property. We'll mention public property a little bit. I also teach natural resources law, which is actually a very large focus on public property. So those of you who become interested in kind of public property and those rules, that we cover that in natural resources. One of the things that your book embraces is the idea that this is a legal positivism book. And we'll talk about that word in a second, that phrase. But the first thing it does is rejects the idea of natural law. It says property is not something that is part of natural law. Not everyone agrees with that. The casebook authors kind of state that as though that's an accepted statement, and it is not. What would it mean for something to be a natural law? What does that mean when we say something is a natural law? Have you heard that phrase before? Yes is a no. What do we think that means, natural law?
Ordained by some divine power.
Ordained by some divine power. Yeah. Any other way to think of natural law? Yeah. I think these are both. You can actually say it also without it being related to God. There's also a way to embody natural law that isn't just that you're getting it from God. There's a kind of a non-religious version.
Something that intuitively feels right, regardless of what government said.
Yeah, I think that's associated with it more.
Inherent in just being a human being.
Yeah. Inherent in just being a human being. Maybe we've inherited that from God, who's some people would say the structure of human beings are like, but it kind of a way to say this, just like it is a right that is inherent just in who we are. Just by existing on this earth, we have a right to property. It is part of ourselves. Now, the book rejects that idea right away, like on page 2 or whatever it is. It says this is not a natural law, but not all theorists do. Some people do argue that property, owning property and having things, is we don't need somebody to write a law to tell us that that's how the world works. We understand intuitively that that's what it means to be a human being, is that we get to own things and make rules about them. A legal positivist approach is an idea that the law has to be on the books, right? That a law is, or even if not written down, that it is a law made by people, right? We created property because it helped us fulfill societal goals. We think that there's a value to it. It helps us not fight with each other if we have property. Maybe it helps us more productively use the land if we have property. There's a lot of different reasons that we have property, but it's not just inherent in being a human. It's because property is a helpful idea. So the book, and I would say actually the majority of property theorists, embrace that idea. We have property. The idea of property is created by man because it is helpful to us. All right, I'm going to go kind of quickly through these five theories of property that we're going to keep coming back to. One is first possession. And we'll talk about this very shortly when we talk about the Fox case. But just that the idea that first in time is first in right, it's a very practical, easy way to determine how somebody owns something. It's a very kind of nice, settled rule. We can kind of get some evidence and figure out who was there first. This idea works really well with unlimited resources. It worked really well with the settling of the United States, where you could just go out there and be first. And we see that the idea also works well with things we think are hard to control. So first in time, first possession, we'll see, still applies to things like wildlife, still applies to oil and gas, still applies to kind of things that are harder for us to kind of, that are more mobile almost. We can also think about this in other ways. We could think about it in your seats here today, right? So you walked in the classroom and you picked a seat. How did you pick that seat? Were you guys in this classroom before? Have you been here before? All right. Did you guys just take the same seats you had last time?
Yeah.
Some. Yes. Those guys are just, that's their seat. Don't mess up. All right. Okay. Did you arrive early to make sure you were going to get those seats?
No, but he saved one for you,
though, right?
I'm not sure why that's the prime seat.
That's the first come, first serve, like, lines are that way too, right? But it's like you come here and you got your first seat. Did anybody get here and somebody was sitting in the seat they really wanted? Yeah, not surprised. You didn't want to be right here?
No.
Right? Close to me? He doesn't know how much I sit down. Did you ask her to move?
No.
No, why not?
I don't think of it. It wasn't that big of a deal to me.
And she's there first, too. It would be a really weird thing, I think, to come and be like, I'd really prefer that seat you were in. And everybody here would know that the rule is first come, first serve, right? Like, we didn't even have to dispute it. It would be really awkward. Unless you had some really kind of compelling reason, like, I'm too short to sit in the front row. That doesn't make sense. But, like, maybe you could have thought of something. But mostly, we have places where first come, first serve works, and we all kind of acknowledge them still. The labor theory of property is one of the most commonly discussed. And this was also some guy writing in the 1600s, John Locke. Anybody heard of John Locke? Oh, nice. In another law class? No, just through life. Awesome. And you guys aren't thinking I mean the guy from Lost, right? Good. All right. So John Locke was writing in a time, he was writing in England, he hadn't even been to the United States, but his ideas were super influential in the United States, including with Thomas Jefferson. And it's the idea of as we work property, as we mix our labor with the land, we are more deserving of it. So let's go back to the car I'm going to give away. Maybe the person who deserves the car is the person who's going to work on the car. They're going to maintain it. They're going to wash it. They're going to fill it with gas. They're going to fix it when it needs repairs. That by kind of investing it with their time and energy, they deserve ownership of it. Again, another theory that works really well if you're talking about a land of unlimited resources. And this is why it was really influential to Thomas Jefferson and the framers of the Constitution, because that's actually kind of the circumstances we were talking about at the time. Jefferson also often talked about this idea of the yeoman farmer. It's kind of connected almost to the idea of, like, the American dream. The idea that every person could go out and work a plot of land and kind of become an owner of land that was their space and that they could kind of make a living and be productive off of that. That was a very fundamental kind of framing of the law. And we will still see that when people talk about who deserves property to something. You could see it in discussion of a tweet, right? What is this? Does Twitter deserve it because it kind of set up this big scheme and big system? Or do you deserve it because you actually had to think about it and write it? Who put more labor and energy into it? Who's more deserving? Utilitarian, we already talked about this one a little bit, just the idea that we should decide our rules based on what's going to maximize social good. Sometimes wealth or money becomes a proxy for this, but it does not need to be. We could think about other ideas. We often see this embedded in law and case law that is just talking about public policy. What is the better public policy? What is going to benefit the most people? And we can see that even in right after our break when we do Pearson v. Post, we'll see kind of this little kind of idea of trying to figure out what's going to be the best rule for the most people. Civic Republican theory, we talk about this one the least. Again, I think this one is, it's the idea that property facilitates democracy. Probably related to the idea that it used to be only that landowners could vote, right? So that therefore if you wanted to be kind of a participant in democracy, you needed to be somebody who actually could own property. If you had rules about who could own property, that was going to limit like who was actually able to participate in the system. Right, that rule about property ownership is gone in this country. But there's still a lot of arguments that actually owning property and having kind of the wherewithal and that comes with being wealthy enough, right? If you have enough standing and wealth in society that you can own things, and it doesn't have to just be land, you're more likely to have to be participating in the democratic process. Landowners, property owners, in terms of real estate, are usually more likely to participate because often the rules about are going to affect their property taxes and things like that. So we do see actually higher voting rates by people who are landowners, but. That one we're talking about a little bit less. Perhaps you have less reliance on government, people say, if you have your own property. I don't know. This is one of my favorites, though. Personhood. This is the idea that property is just kind of necessary for your personal development.
and that we often kind of develop close ties to property. And that property, then, items, whether it's, you know, the house you live in or perhaps your father's watch, which was carried back by a fellow soldier, perhaps these things have a larger value to it than actually their monetary value. Right? Does anyone have an item that they kind of give more value to than you could probably, than you could sell it for? A ring from your grandmother, right? That's a great example. Family heirlooms, right? Something that if you took it to the store, you know, the $100 they're going to offer it for you, it's like there's nowhere near what you really think it's worth, what you'd be willing to accept it, in exchange for it. And now it doesn't mean you wouldn't necessarily be willing to sell it, but maybe you'd be willing to sell it for $5,000 instead of $100, right? I'm not suggesting you sell it, but you know, that there's two things. One is the idea that you would never part with it, but one is just the idea that the value to you is going to be higher than it might be to somebody else. Anything else? Anybody else have something that they...
It's like this disgusting stuffed dog that's like been passed down through like everybody in my family.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure you're not going to get any money for that,
yeah,
right?
Exactly. It's
yeah,
just like
stuffed animals. Like, yeah, I don't know what it's about. People like put a lot of like emotional value into a stuffed animal, and that's something that you're just not ever going to be able to sell on the market. I can't get rid of stuffed animals; they're overwhelming my home. Right? I actually have trouble with this. I cannot think of anything in my life that I give that much value to. It's a But we know that people do. But not only that, you can think of it even in small ways. Right? You can think of it even in, there's this idea called the endowment theory, right? Which is that you give your property, the longer you have something, the more money it's going to take to get it away from you. Strangely enough, this is true for me with my coffee mug. I'm like really attached to this coffee mug. If I went out and bought a new one, it's $18. But if somebody came up and offered me $18 for it, I'm not likely to accept that. I'm probably going to hold out for like $30. So it's not like I'm asking for $100 for it, but it's just like, I like this mug so much, it would be such a pain for me to go out and get a new one. I'm going to value it higher. Jeans, right? Like, I don't know. People really like, these jeans finally fit. You know, I'm not selling them for even what I paid for them, even though now they're worn in. And this has been shown with all different things. They've done these studies where they just, like, handed out candy bars to people. And then when they tried to buy them back, people are like, oh, I'm gonna hold on to this. not for long, but just, like, until you offer me a little bit more money for it. Like, it's now that I've held on to it for a while, it's worth more to me than just the dollar that I could have paid for it. This is all related to this idea that we'll see over and over again, that there is kind of, people have emotional attachments to property. They definitely have it to their home, right? There's a lot of people who don't want to sell their home for fair market value. It means much more to them than fair market value, right? So these are the theories, and we'll see them, and we'll talk about them in our cases, and we'll let's take a 10-minute break, and then we'll go through our cases for today. Are there snacks out there? What? Okay, I'd like to get to our case call. I'm like always notoriously behind schedule. I'll get them at the end. I was actually looking for the blank ones, and then so people who handed me their filled-in ones is fine. Okay, guys, what's up with this? How come you guys like are writing? Everybody's like half of them are upside down. Like, what? You're like, I'm going to make it extra tricky on her. Every other person, write your name upside down. I'm going to figure it out. I can read upside down. Kind of. Okay, all right. I want to talk about Pearson v. Post today. I like to call on people for the cases, but it's class one, so I'll take volunteers, and if not, then I'll call on people. Anyone want to volunteer for Pearson v. Post, one of the most famous cases in all of property law? Yes, and what's your name?
Christian.
All right, Christian. All right, Pearson v. Post. Can you explain very briefly the facts here?
Sure. Volunteer set out his hound to capture a fox. Scooted him over a long distance. The fox eventually ran onto someone else's private property. That person shot him, and the fox was his own.
Yeah, almost. We have one thing a little bit off on that. Okay, but we do have, all right, so we have just a story of fox hunting, right? And notice it's New York, 1805. This is one of the For some reason, one of the most famous cases in all of property law, it is one of these cases that later when you meet attorneys from, everybody will be able to talk about the Fox case. Like, everybody has this case. Most people have it their first day of property. It is kind of one of these few cases, I don't know, there's a couple of them out there. There are like these unifying moments that lawyers have. You can refer to the Fox case in 20 years from now, and everyone will remember what you're talking about. All right, here's the very artistic drawing I have of it for you, right? Which is that Post is out hunting. He's out hunting, and he has dogs. He owns a bunch of dogs. He brings them hunting with him. How long is he out hunting, Christian?
I'm assuming a while is insufficient.
Yeah, no, but it's like all day. He's out there all day. He's out there a long time. It's not like he just walked out the door with his gun. He's been out there hunting and chasing this fox. Now, at the moment, he's kind of cornered the fox with his dogs. He's kind of come in and get the fox. What does Post do? Just takes that fox. So annoying. Right? Imagine you've been hunting all day. Your hounds, your dogs are the ones that have first chased the fox out of hiding. You've been following it all day on your horse, and you get very close to where the fox is, and somebody else shoots the fox and takes it. The thing I wanted to correct Christian about what you said is where they were. Does anyone say where were? They weren't on private, on Post's land when it happened. The beach is what they call this area. There's another phrase they say in there. Does anyone see what else they call it?
Wasteland.
Wasteland, the beach, wasteland. This is Long Island, very wealthy area of Long Island nowadays. So you can think of Long Island as wasteland. Right, so this is, it's like the Hamptons, I think. But what it is it's public land. I think our case would be different if Post had owned the property. If we had actually any property owner involved, we would have a little bit of a different discussion. We'll put that aside for later and think of what it might mean if we had a property owner. But neither of them own the property, so we're taking that out of our analysis of who should own it. Okay. The procedure here is a little weird. In case it was confusing, it's just like a terminology change. So the plaintiff, of course, in the first case was Post suing to get the fox back. And then Post won, and now they kind of switch. Instead of just saying the defendant on appeal, they now make the defendant the plaintiff. It's just don't get tripped up by those words. It's kind of an old type of procedure that we don't do anymore, just the way they sue. Okay, so Post sued Pearson. Sorry, I even get their names confused. All right, Pearson kills the fox. Sorry, Pearson. Post sues Pearson to get the fox back. What happened in the lower court?
The lower court decided in favor of Pearson.
Okay, and now what is what about this court? What about the majority? Who owns this fox?
Majority felt that they were bound by precedent and decided in favor of Pearson.
What precedent were they bound by?
That possessing wild animal gives one property over it is not pursued.
Was that a case that they cited?
No, they decided the Roman law, Justinian's Institute.
Yeah, so actually what we have here is we don't have precedent. We don't have precedent. There was no previous case determining ownership of a fox that was being chased. Right? There was no statute on point either about kind of what the rules were for hunting. So instead, we have the court looking to other sources of law to try and guide it. In this case, Christian's right, they look to the Justinian.
Let me think. I had a slide. Oh, no.
I don't know. I thought I had a slide of Justinian. Not that it's that interesting. They look to Justinian. They look to Bracton. They look to my favorite jurist, Puffendorf. And then one I can't even say. The thing of this is this looking to a treatise, right? So nowadays we would look at a treatise. We would look at like Powell on Property, a very good property treatise. So this is, they didn't have kind of the same kind of handbooks that we had. They didn't have any law points. So they're going back and looking at kind of legal theorists for ideas of what might be the best. All right, so looking at those legal theorists, Christian, what is the rule? Why does they decide that the fox should go to Pearson?
These legal theorists have decided that one could only playing a wild animal fair in Naturae if they actually took possession of the animal.
Right, so what does that mean to take possession of the animal? What do you have to show?
You have to claim the corpse, actually have it.
Yeah, so do you actually have to have it? Do you have to physically have it? That might be what's going to show that you are the owner. The one that who's actually chasing it might not be enough. There's a couple different terms they use instead of possession.
I was just going to say you've been mortally wounded. Yeah.
Mortally wounded? What and why? Based on what rule?
Yeah.
Occupancy. They use this term occupancy. The person who gets the fox has to have occupancy, has to occupy the fox. I don't know. So we have to figure out then what occupancy means. Perhaps it means to mortally wound. Perhaps it means that you have to actually physically have possession of it. But so they go through and they try to figure out what would it mean to occupy a fox. Now notice this is relied upon the idea that this is a wild animal, that we think there's something special about the creatures of wild animals, that the only way to really show that you're an owner of them is to have occupancy. All right, so what does it mean to occupy a fox? What should be enough here?
They talk about depriving the animal of its natural liberty.
Depriving the animal of its natural liberty? So mortally wounding is occupancy because the animal no longer has liberty? Okay. All right, so now if you wound it, but you haven't mortally wounded it, is that occupancy?
No.
Okay, what if you have it, if you kill it, we agree on that one, right? What if you put it in a cage? Have you occupied it? I guess if it's depriving them of their natural liberty, we would say yes. This becomes kind of this tricky thing to figure out at what point is it enough what they've done. Now the phrase the court uses is reducing it to your control. So you have to show that you have total control over this animal. So a wounded animal that's still running away, you don't have control over it. Mortally wounded animal that you're going to just like walk up and catch, you have control over it. Something that you're physically holding, physically in a cage, you have control over it. So this is the rule of capture. And we'll see that it's used actually in other areas of the law. But the first time in the United States that we see it in a case is the Pearson v. Post, articulating this idea that there are certain things, wild animals and other fugitive resources, that you become the owner of it based on the rule of capture. And the majority develops that rule based upon looking at these kind of old treatises, property philosophers and jurists from Rome and from Germany and England. All right, but what about the dissent? What is the? That's Justinian and Bracton there. What is the dissent's argument here, Christian?
The dissent. He argues like the same decision should be reached but a different rationale. That foxes are dangerous animals and the law should encourage bushwhackers to kill them. Like because Pearson killed fox first, he should be rewarded with them.
Actually, that's not the reasoning. You're starting off with the right idea that foxes are noxious animals, right? There's like this really kind of negative feeling about foxes in this dissent. This guy hates foxes. These are terrible things. They're like ruining society. And so, therefore, who should we reward? Should it be Pearson, who is actually ridding us of this noxious animal? That seems like a pretty good thing. Yeah.
I believe you stated that post pursuing the fox with his house's waves and interest in the animal. And I believe he said exactly, in the animal has to have a right of action against another who in view of the husband and his dogs, who will pursue him with knowledge of the chase, to kill and carry him away. So it's kind of like a question like, okay, you can see clearly he's in pursuit of this fox.
So I think that tells us, like, we could have a discussion what we just feel is fair. Like, do we feel like Pearson was a jerk?
But the dissent is doing something a little bit different in that and trying to discuss what should we be rewarded. The dissent is really taking kind of a utilitarian approach. Like, what are the types of behavior we want to reward if we think that foxes are a terrible thing? Yeah.
Post pretty much, or the dissent pretty much argues that Post, you know, kept his pack of hounds. He started this chase. He was actually, like, really trying to get this fox. So we should reward him so that other people can really go and chase foxes and get rid of all foxes.
We want to reward the people who invest the money in keeping hounds and horses and having organized fox hunts, right? If these people, because that costs that's a lot of time and energy he put in, right? A lot of time, a lot of money to kind of have these hounds that he trains, have the horses he rides or whatever. And that if we allow people at the very end of a fox hunt to like come in and take that fox, nobody is going to invest the money and energy into actually having a fox hunt, right? You're not going to sit in. Do we have any hunters in here? Anyone hunt? Just two of you. Okay, right. So the idea is like, three of you. Okay, so the idea is like, you're not going to sit there and kind of, you know, put all this time and energy into investing in all of the gear you might need if somebody could come and take that animal away from you at the last minute. Now, I don't know. I think even thinking about that argument could go both ways. I do think in some ways that Christiana is right. Like, if we actually value getting rid of foxes, it should be. Maybe we should value Pearson, who was able to actually kill that fox. Maybe he's a much more efficient hunter or something, that he got in 2 minutes and this guy took all day chasing it down. Maybe that's the better thing to value. Maybe we'd actually have to look at why people do fox hunting, and I'm not sure how much of it is like because we want to get rid of foxes. I think there's a lot of fox hunting that just had to do with kind of the experience and the culture of fox hunting. It wasn't really an endeavor to rid the world of foxes. But we see that there's... That's the public policy approach of the dissent. We want to reward, we want to make property rules based on behavior that we think is the right behavior to encourage. Now, what is the majority's argument for why we should instead go to look at, make this rule followed by, from Justinian? Why do they think that, from a public policy standpoint, why do they think that's a better approach? Yeah.
Because if ownership, you got it just through press suit, it would start too many arguments and there would be too much litigation.
Yeah, there would be too... It just wouldn't be a very clear rule. The nice thing about the rule of capture, it's a nice, clear rule. We don't need to go to court that often. We don't need to have as many fights. We just have a clear, settled property rule. We benefit all the time when we have clear, settled rules, right? It makes it easier for us to know what the answer is, to figure out who owns something. Easier for courts, but even just easier for people, right? Like, I know that I own this. I'm not going to... Maybe there'll be less arguments. So those are kind of... If we think about trying to use public policy or utilitarian approach, maximizing social welfare to make our property rules, we see that that's the debate. Which of these is more important to us? Is it more important to have a settled rule, or is it more important for us to kill those noxious beasts? And so that's the debate. And in this case, the majority prevailed in at least persuading the other judge on the court. What if we went back to our property theories? So we know this is a story of first possession, right? That's what this case is about. So first possession, it goes to Pearson. What about the labor theory? Who might be rewarded under the labor theory?
I feel like what we were talking about earlier, the labor theory would be more with the dissent and who is investing their time in with the dogs and everything like that.
Yeah. So I think that's probably right. I think we see that they're investing kind of time and energy and perhaps therefore more rewarding of the property in the end. Civic Republican theory, I have no thoughts on which one would leads to better democracy. Either one. What about personhood, though? Could we say that either of these men had a stronger attachment to the fox? Yeah.
Well, given that Post is training dogs to go hunting for foxes and he does it regularly, he probably attaches some form of his identity to foxes.
Yeah, and note that he chose to sue over this fox in the first place, right? He's taking we're going all the way to the highest court in New York over a fox, a pelt right now, a fox carcass,
that's, you know, now a year old. So I guess the value of the fox carcass at the time it was killed. But very little, much lower sum than the amount of money spent bringing the case in the first place, which suggests to you that this was not just about a fox, that these guys probably had some deeper dispute going on between the two of them. But we do, if we think about the personhood theory, we might, you know, so personhood and labor, we might in both of these reward Post as being the one who's kind of really kind of invested in this process and in the fox. So you can see how thinking about different theories of property can lead to different results, and we will see all the time judges and justices embracing different theories to try and get to the answer. Well, let's just, the last thing I want to go back to that ratione soli. So it's only mentioned in passing in here. Christian, did you pick up on that? What the ratione soli? Wait, did anybody ever study Latin in here? Nobody can pronounce my. How am I? Ratione soli? Am I just murdering that? Close enough? All right. Christian, what does that mean? Did you see that anywhere? Pick up on what that might mean.
Ratione soli.
Haley, can you help us out?
According to
soil, what does that mean?
The land.
Right.
I looked it up, I saw it.
Yeah. Okay, but what does it mean if we say that if we're going to make a property rule that's according to the soil when we're talking about a fox?
Is that in terms of when you're talking more on public property, not private, so...
Yeah, right. It's about where are we when we kill that fox? Because there's some, in many jurisdictions, they would have a rule that the wild animal belongs to the person who owns the property. I'm not sure where it would come out because sometimes they still have a rule that, this again will vary by state, sometimes if you are in the midst of a chase, you are allowed to chase an animal onto private property, it doesn't automatically become that landowner's property. This is kind of, all of these have been, you know, now we have a lot of laws governing hunting, a lot of laws on the books. But this is, if we go back to a time before, we had a lot of statutes that kind of dictated the rules of hunting, and we had to look at kind of just common law. Ratione soli was the person who owns the property, owns the wildlife that is on that property, only for the time that it's on the property, right? So, you know, this fox runs through your yard, you're like, I own it, no, I don't. I know that. No, I don't, right? So it's like if you were, and if somebody else killed it while it was on your property, it would become yours. So I just point that out. It's not actually a very useful rule for kind of current thinking about wildlife because we have so many statutes that govern wildlife now and how we hunt and where, but that is, there are some states that still embrace that rule. All right, one of the things that the dissent suggests is that we submit this to a panel of sportsmen instead of going to the court. Here's our panel of sportsmen over there. What would you guys, my three hunters, what would you have, who do you think should have gotten this fox?
It probably would have been a fist fight.
A fist fight?
Yeah, that's what that obviously means it's extremely ignorant. What?
But okay, but all right, it would have resulted, we can see that these guys probably hate each other, it would have been a fist fight. But if we were to submit it to the you three and say, okay, hunters, you know the policy, not policy, but you know like the habits and traditions and kind of conduct, right, of how hunters treat each other.
Post. Yeah, I mean, you generally don't. If someone's stalking an animal, you generally don't. And you know that what they're doing, you don't go after the same.
Yeah, I think that actually the hunters all like would agree. Like this is kind of why you say, like, you know, ask any hunter, they'll tell you that what this guy did was unacceptable. It was kind of breaking the code, the traditions. Yeah.
Not a hunter, would it? Post was just mad at training dogs. Could go to the
different
thing, like
try our
Simon
Kinect box. Right, exactly. That's why I say maybe he's just say Pearson's a much more efficient hunter. But I do think that like there is still kind of the tradition of hunting would still give that person who's a bad hunter the opportunity to kind of try to keep getting that animal. Right? He was kind of in hot pursuit, right? He was very close, nearby. He was able to see the whole thing happen. So we do see here sometimes that the custom would have led to something different. Let's take a totally different type of case. Oh wait, let's do these really quickly. All right. Post shoots a deer from a location 200 feet away. The shot grazes the deer's ear and temporarily stuns it. Pearson immediately snatches the deer and puts it in a large sack. Post arrives 1 minute later while the deer is still stunned. All right. Is that enough to kind of fulfill our kind of occupancy requirement? Has Post brought it under his control? Who should get the deer in this scenario? Yeah.
Post, because it's still stunned, what do you guys say?
It's stunned. So what does that mean?
Then it's already been brought under his control because it wouldn't have gone anywhere anyway.
Now, if he had gotten there much later and the deer had kind of come to its senses and walked away, temporary control is okay?
If it had gotten up and started walking away, then it would have Pearson and he broke the sack after the back guy's in.
Yeah. Does it matter how much later, how quickly, or how long it took Post to arrive on the scene?
Yes, because you lose control of it if you wouldn't have got there in time.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think we would say that I think the court would find that stunning the deer to the point where it's like it does not, it's, it is at least temporarily deprived of its own freedom of movement, is enough to say that you have kind of exerted enough control that it equals occupancy. Okay, what about this one? Motivated by environmental concerns, Post nets a wild rabbit, paints property of Post on it, and then allows it to run free. I used to do this when I was a kid with turtles. I know it's a terrible thing to do. I did. Okay, Pearson shoots and kills the rabbit. What do you think? David, maybe you can help us with this.
He captures a wild rabbit, murdering nature, or however I murder that Latin phrase, and he puts my property on it and lets it go again.
It's the wild, unless you have fence or some sort of domesticated animal, it's still a wild animal.
Yeah. Right? So there's a lot of cases on this. So So if you have a wild animal, and there's cases on this because sometimes people catch wild animals and wild animals escape. They don't just release them in the wild, but they escape. And so the next person catches it. So sometimes they say, okay, well, could we tell the wild animal was there? Is there a reason why we think it wasn't a wild animal? If everything makes you think this is a wild animal that's just in the wild, then then the next person who captures it makes sense. Under the rule of capture, I mean, Post hasn't continued his control over it. Having just your name painted on it is not exerting control over a wild animal. There are some cases, actually, surprisingly, that go a little bit differently, that they say that, you know, kind of that having that painting, being the painting on the animal, should have kind of alerted Pearson to the fact that this was more than just a normal wild animal, that there was something special to it. It comes up more with, like, tagged animals, right? Okay, how about this one? Zachary, number one. All right, Post chases a fox into a shallow cave, but before he can get to the cave, Pearson shoots the fox and mortally wounds it. He arrives at the cave 2 minutes later. Is a cave enough to kind of exert enough control over it? Let's go this way.
Okay. I'd say that the cave is in total control because it could have a way to escape the back of the cave, so it wouldn't... it could still escape and then it could have time again, so...
Everyone agree? Anyone think that, like, into a cave, it's a cave, you know it's a dead-end cave, you've chased it into there, have you kind of deprived it of its liberty at that point? Enough to say that you have control over it? Yeah.
I see what Joe's saying between a cave with dogs like barking outside of it as if you're a cage.
You said, yeah.
If you want to view your dogs being another sort of barrier on the outside of the cave, you feel like you had a cage.
Yeah, I think that's a good analogy. If we think of the cave, but I think this is a close one. You could see a court going either way here. Like, all we're trying to figure out is how much control do they have over that animal? Has it been enough that we're going to call it occupancy? If we liken the cave to a cage and say, look, they were like in a penned in area that they couldn't really escape from, that'd be one thing. I guess the hard part is he's not actually physically there yet, and it seems like more that the cage is, feels more just like the woods or a natural feature. How did he even know he was in the cave? Or how? You might have to do a lot of facts, right? We might have to actually have a lot of facts to kind of question these guys and figure out, had you purposely cornered it into it? Was this part of your plan? Do you feel like you had control over it? They get tricky. How about this, though? Post cow strays onto unowned land. Pearson finds the cow, places a rope around its neck, leads it back to his own farm. 2 days later, Post discovers the cow on Pearson's farm. Do we get any different result in this one?
Okay, so the cow strays onto unowned land, but Pearson takes the cow back to his house. And it's in his backyard. And then Post comes by and says, he's got my cow in the backyard. I want a pet. Does he get it back, or can Pearson be like, hey man, it was out in the wild. I found it. Straight up your land. If you want to keep your cow, you better keep control over it. You better keep it in the cage. What do you think?
I'll go back. Post, because it was Post. The cow just escaped Post's land.
No, but if it was a wild animal and it escaped.
Yeah, I wouldn't say the cow wasn't. It wasn't wild.
Right, so this is the difference. We make a distinction. This is no longer ferrare naturae. I'm sure there's a Latin phrase that means your own property that I don't remember what it is. Right, that we make a distinction if it's the rule of capture is really for wild animals. And if you can show that the animal is not wild, that it's a domesticated animal, you get it back. And this, there's sometimes it's tricky to show whether or not an animal is a domesticated animal. There's a case where somebody was raising silver foxes for their fur to make, I don't know, fox fur coats, I guess. But in the wild, could you tell that that was a domesticated animal? Well, if you were a really savvy hunter in that area, you knew that there weren't naturally silver foxes in that area, that is not kind of a common animal. But if you didn't know that much about foxes, you might not realize that it was something unusual. So there's sometimes these questions about what's a domesticated animal become tricky. But we see that the rule of capture then is actually kind of can be quite narrow. And we'll almost, this scenario is almost helpful when we get to the very kind of complicated legal doctrine of finders keepers. All right, but let's talk about White versus Samsung. All right. Do I have a volunteer for this one? Anyone want to do White? Sure. And your name is Will?
Yeah.
Got it. Okay. All right. Will, what's going on here? What are the basic facts?
So Vanna White is on the Craigslist of Wheel of Fortune. Yeah, Wheel of Fortune. She's like turns the letters or whatever, and Samsung does a commercial ad of basically making things that are like still relevant in the future, and their ad featured a robot with blonde hair and a wig and a dress very similar to Vanna White, and the Wheel of Fortune basically saying that it would still be relevant in 2012 or whatever it was.
Yeah.
Vanna White sued, saying that it's like her own personal property.
Okay, so what is her property? What is she arguing is her property? The robot?
No, the right to like publicity.
The right to publicity. Okay, so this is what I'm talking about. We have kind of, you know, throughout history, every now and then, like new kind of ideas of property rights emerge. A right to publicity is not something we had in the 1800s. This is a relatively recent idea, a right to publicity. I'm sorry that these pictures aren't it's not a little darker in here. What I do find interesting about these ads is like I don't know how like she's actually still on the show. Like she still is the one who turns it. Nobody needed a robot, and it is in fact the longest running game show. So I was like, and the other one is like steak being a health food, which is kind of like what I don't know. I feel like people say that now too. So, I don't know, Samsung was very prescient there. Okay, all right, so here's the question of what does Vanna White own? What does it mean to have a right of publicity? So what is the right of publicity? Is it she own her voice, her image?
Yes, yeah, like the right to her image and her own intellectual property, I guess, so to speak, or what she does, yeah, like her likeness.
Okay, well, you said a few things there. Is it her image? Okay, is that robot an image of Vanna White?
Well, I would agree with, like, almost the court, I think it was their dissent or whatever, that yes, when you put all those factors together, but it's really the Wheel of Fortune of the image, not really necessarily her.
Yes.
They said that, like, when you just took it out everything else, she is just somebody that's in a dress, blonde.
Yeah.
And like that, but then when you add everything else, like the board, the letters,
Right, so you have to think about, like, what is it that she actually has a right to? Now, we're not talking about them using her voice. We're not talking about them actually using her face. In a lot of the case law, in a lot of the statutes, right, there's the right to publicity is a statute that's not in every state, but, you know, they talk about images and likeness. So then the question is, what does it mean for it to be a likeness? Is this a likeness of her? What do we have to show? When you see that ad, when you see that picture, do you automatically think of Vanna White? Everybody does, right? Like you, and partially also because by this point, nobody else has ever had that job. She's the only one who's ever had that job, and I think she's had, like, no other job, right? So, like, the, you know, any, I think anybody anywhere turning things around, turning tiles around is going to remind you of Vanna White. But why is that? It's not necessarily because of what her, she looks like physically. It's because that is her persona. She is the person who turns the tiles around. And so the question is, how much protection should we give her for that?
Right? So California law protects the celebrity's sole right to exploit their, and this is how they their phrase, marketable celebrity identity value. All right, so now it's like celebrity identity. What is it that she should really get a right to? Is it anything that that makes us think it's her? Is it anything that is associated with her? Is it something, or does it have to be her image? Now let's think about this from kind of our public policy standpoint. What is it that we are trying to protect? Why have a right? Why have a right of publicity? Well, what are we trying to protect? Why do we promote that?
Her investments.
In what interests, though?
Well, they said that, like, celebrities have a very big market value of, like, when they endorse something or when they're buying something, so they can lose their own money or it could be hurting them publicly.
How would it hurt them publicly? I'm just having trouble.
Well, like, if you're not really, like, behind something, like, I don't know, like, if you're not really, like, I don't know, like, an example. Derek Jeter's, like, they say that he loves Axe, like, body spray, but he really doesn't.
What?
I don't know what to say.
Okay, right. No. Okay, you're right. There's two ideas. There's two main kind of public policy interests, perhaps. One being just the idea that we want to protect her ability to make money off of her own persona, right? That she has developed this, and they even say kind of, whether it's by accident or through your hard work, you get the right to kind of make the money off of your developed persona, your developed identity. The other thing they say is, the other thing you can think about is this idea of wanting to protect that person. You don't want just anybody to be able to put your image all over the place. What if it's somebody you really disagree with? What if it's a product you really hate? You don't want it to kind of diminish your value in other ways by kind of associating you with something that you don't actually endorse. So these are the ideas of why states have a right to publicity. Both of those kind of things are like the public policy behind why we think we could identify that as a property right and then protect it. The question is really how far that should go, and I think that's what Kaczynski is trying to get at. Like, do we really feel like bad for Vanna White here? Do we feel like she has, if you were to see that ad, would you think that Vanna White was endorsing Samsung? Most of you guys are shaking your heads no. I don't think so. I think you would understand that Samsung was kind of almost making a parody, that they were kind of, that they're not actually suggesting either that Wheel of Fortune or that Vanna White are endorsing their product. They're just kind of talking about things that'll still be around in the future, and they are referencing that product. But so I don't think we have kind of this likelihood of confusion about whether or not you think there's endorsement. So then the only real public policy here that we might be seeking to protect is either Wheel of Fortune or Vanna White's ability to make money off of their own control of their own image or their own likeness.
They also mentioned that there should be a consideration of rights of business in general, and accessing it and benefiting from sort of general cultural norms, understood implications that have become a fabric of sort of cultural identity that belongs to everyone, and shouldn't that have some level of protection in regard to reaching into and marketing, connecting with their audience based on something that's so ingrained in cultural pattern?
Yeah, I think so, right? It's like, you know, I think that there really is something. I think I feel like it's one of those things where you're reading the opinion and you're totally with Judge Goodwin. You're like, yeah, this makes sense. This wasn't fair. I agree. When I saw that, I totally thought of Vanna White. There was no confusion on my part about whether or not this was about Vanna White. It's clearly her. It's clearly them kind of appropriating and using her likeness to make money. And then I'm persuaded again the other way when I read Kaczynski's dissent. All right, does anybody understand kind of actually procedurally? Well, did you understand procedurally what his kind of dissent is? Is he a dissent in the three-judge panel?
I kind of just took it that he was kind of saying that, like, it really isn't part of it.
Yeah, just like procedurally, though. Do we understand where his opinion is coming from? He is not part of the original three-judge panel. This is kind of an unusual procedural thing, and Judge Kaczynski is often credited with being, like, the person who really brought this procedural way of writing an opinion into being. He is now the chief judge of the Ninth Circuit, and what this is panel opinion, right? The circuit we know is three judges, so the three judges issues their opinion. After that, I believe it's 30 days, maybe the day slightly, number of days slightly off, but all the parties who were subject to that opinion, right, so all of the parties involved, have 30 days to petition for a rehearing by the entire circuit. Right, so, and now this is done as a matter of course. I would think it's actually, would almost be malpractice nowadays to not bring a petition for rehearing. You ask for a rehearing by that same judge panel, and then you ask for, you petition to have it reheard by the entire circuit if it didn't go your way. And what happens then is all of the active judges on that circuit vote to determine whether or not it should be heard by all of them. The judges on the Ninth Circuit voted and decided that they did not want to all hear this case, that it would not be reheard by the entire Ninth Circuit. And what Kaczynski is doing is he's dissenting from that decision. He's saying, no, we should have all heard this. We should have taken this to the entire Ninth Circuit and heard it again because I think that the original three-judge panel was so wrong. So it's like this dissent from a petition for a rehearing en banc. And it's procedurally very interesting because he wasn't actually on the three-judge panel.
It's not clear ever what precedential value these have other than they are very influential to the Supreme Court. That you can think of them as messages to the Supreme Court to please take up this case. Okay, so this is so now Will tell us, what did he say though in dissent from the denial of the hearing?
He felt that it was like kind of almost encroaching on intellectual property and like the expansion of it. He was saying that like intellectual property is meant to protect like the author and stuff like that, but like at the same time let people build off of that. Such.
What is the harm of overprotecting intellectual property?
That, like, you can, I guess, creativity or so, or the flow of creativity wouldn't really kind of emerge. Or...
It's a very fine line to walk. On one hand, we want to protect intellectual property because we want to protect the people, almost like labor theory, we want to protect the people who put their time and energy into making that intellectual property. We want to protect your song because we want you to write more songs. We want to protect your patent because we want you to make more patents and kind of increase the creativity and the wonderful things we have in society. So if we don't protect them, people won't have the same motivations to engage in those activities. But if we overprotect them, then we might hamper other people who might have kind of built off of your ideas and done something even better and something even newer. So if we restrain too much intellectual property, we stifle creativity. So you can see that this is a very tough line to walk in if we're trying to think of our goal as just kind of flourishing of society, how figure out where we are. He feels like we've drawn the line in the wrong place here. We are kind of just stifling people making up kind of creative spins on popular culture ideas. In a way that is, it's kind of funny to think of it because it's like, oh, are we really need to promote Samsung making more commercials? Is that really making society better? But his point is that it's not just this commercial for Samsung. It's the idea that people can't even make references to popular culture because if you can vaguely identify it as being a reference to somebody, it's going to be prohibited, and that's too much. So we can see that we have these battles over new ideas of property rights, and we're going back to some of our same kind of property theories to try and figure that out. So, right, the labor theory being very influential here. Who put time and energy into that? What did she do for that commercial? You could say she did a lot because she put time and energy to building up her persona. Or you could say that she didn't do much because she didn't write the commercial. The other people wrote the commercial. They put their time and energy into writing it. Utilitarian theory is just what we were talking about. Like, what is better for public policy, to protect this or not? What about personhood here? Right of publicity and personhood. Where does the arrow lean there? What?
More towards Vanna.
More towards Vanna, absolutely, right? She is going to have a much strong... The right of publicity, always, right? That's got to be... And the right of publicity is in some way acknowledging how strong property and personhood are tied together, right? It is totally a part of who she is, this thing. It's connected to her. Samson is not going to be hurt or offended by this commercial. She is, right? And it's part of her and who she is. So we can see that, majority, Judge Goodwin, he's really thinking more about personhood. That is a more important element to him, the personhood idea, than perhaps kind of thinking about the utilitarian approach that Kaczynski takes. Showing us that we see these, even if they are not explicitly stating it, even if the judge doesn't say, well, based on Radin's theory of personhood, I think this should go to Vanna White, we see that those are the underlying themes that are helping them make their decision about who should own which things. Oh my gosh, I have like no time. All right, we'll just do the hypothesis. All right. A sells a video football game that features virtual players, the jersey number, height, weight, hometown, and playing statistics. For each player is the same for actually the currently enrolled college for a currently enrolled college player. But it's not his name and it doesn't look like him. Has his right of publicity been violated? Let's go to Amanda. What do you think? Doesn't look like him, so we can't say it's his image. So we don't have a voice involved. Is this enough of his likeness? Following Goodwin, right? Because Goodwin is the one that was actually the majority opinion. Is this enough of his likeness?
I think using the likeness, you could argue that it is because it uses the same statistics, such as, like, you could use height, weight, hometown, you know.
Do you think that's enough?
I think if you use this, you can make that argument.
All right, what do you guys think? If you saw it, if you're like, wow, that's exactly the same stats for so-and-so. Do you think that would be enough for you to realize it would gotta be that guy?
Well, the chances are higher, astronomical, that it wouldn't be the same person as somebody else on the team already. So, like, you're like the Alabama law student at UCLA, who's a college player, who's pseudo video game. But, I mean, in this case, his name would be on the jersey, but how many people who look like, or not look like, have the same height, weight, hometown, and play for UCLA?
Yeah.
It's really unlikely.
All right. Yeah.
I would say if you're playing the game, you could presume the person playing the game is a fan of football, specifically college football, and therefore they would know things like height, weight, position, hometown, and jersey number. And therefore, if you gave that information, that's enough to signal who it is.
Okay. So maybe
there's no reason why they would include it if they weren't trying to signal.
Right. Right. If they didn't want to make it that person, just change the hometown. Right. Just change one stat. I do think it's different than Vanna White in that not immediately is everybody, but I think you look at that Vanna White ad and you don't even have a hesitation, you think Vanna White. This one, maybe you have to think about it for a minute because it doesn't look like him. Right? So it's like, well, it doesn't look like him, it's nothing. But, like all the other stats are the same. So I think you're right. I think it's enough. I think it's enough that under Goodwin, so in California, right, so the right of publicity is a state law, so it changes in each state. I think under California, we would say that this is enough, but that is his likeness. It's enough that it invokes you, that you think, it invokes him. You think of him and who that is when you're doing it. You want to add something?
I was going to disagree with you. I think that the Vanna White thing, I've never watched Wheel of Fortune, and I didn't know who that was.
Oh, really?
Because I wouldn't have really known. So I think it matters that if you're a fan,
okay,
of what it is.
All right, well, I would say in the 1990s it might have been a little different. I do think it was, like, first of all, there was far fewer TV stations. All right, other people know who Vanna White is?
Yes.
Yes.
Other people thought of Vanna White when they saw that?
Yes.
Yeah. All right, it's probably just a numbers thing. I think there's probably more people that would recognize Vanna White that quickly than would sit there and kind of process and realize who that football player was. I think mostly because of the image. Like, we think so much of image as being what the person looks like. And if that video game image of the person looked totally different, I think that would make people maybe pause for a minute, and then you stop and look at the stats. You're like, well, wait a minute, isn't that so-and-so? All right, I think he wins in California. All right, B writes a book about the impact of Martin Luther King on the civil rights movement, the focus sold to the public. Has MLK's right of publicity been violated? Oh, wait. I was going to call.
Look back in the chart.
Oh, now. How do you pronounce your name? King?
No,
Xing. Xing?
Yeah.
Well, I'll try to practice that one. Okay. Wait, what do you think here? Has MLK's right to publicity been violated?
I don't think it's a violation to ask me about certain things. Right, because it's not about him directly. The imagine or voice.
Right. Yeah, we don't have a likeness, right? We definitely don't have maybe there's pictures in it, but they probably do have cover. But we don't have an image, a voice, a likeness. We have somebody writing and describing. And writing and describing is okay. We have kind of different public policy things. So we have kind of the freedom of expression here and freedom of the press saying that we can write and describe about things, right? I mean, this would be really hard, actually, if this was true. I would get in trouble for a lot of things I write, right? Like, any time that I actually wrote and started describing somebody or something they said, that I would be violating that person's right of publicity. We think there's something different when you're kind of writing and describing about something. There's no attempt to me to actually using MLK's image to promote something, perhaps, we would say. But we can see how we think that this is different. Even without knowing the law, we would say that's something different. All right, number 7. C invents a new dance style that reminds some people the way Michael Jackson danced. I was thinking about this yesterday with Bruno Mars at the Super Bowl. Oh, yeah, Super Bowl. Rule of capture there. Like, I was really annoying all the people I was watching the Super Bowl with, right? Because I was like, oh, does he possess the ball right now? Has he brought it under his complete control? You know, like... How much is a football like a fox? At what point? At what point do we draw that line that it is firmly his football, right? So, yeah, in case you want to be annoying. All right, so, okay, but C is paid to perform the dance on a television show. Has Michael Jackson's right of publicity been violated? Oh, wait, the other one.
Tell me how to pronounce your name, Leon. Leon Hoover?
Okay. All right, what do you think? Has Michael Jackson, somebody has a dance style that's kind of based on his... I think this is exactly the type of activity that Kaczynski is trying to promote, right? He's trying to say, we want people to build on creativity.
This is no image, not a likeness. Maybe it reminds some people. I don't think it would be enough to really violate Michael Jackson's right of publicity. But we see this is exactly the type of line drawing that happens when you make when you have something like the right of publicity. If it's not actually somebody's image and voice and you start talking about their likeness, it's really hard to figure out exactly where that falls. Okay. Do we end at 11 or 11:15? I didn't know that. Oh, my God. I was thinking I would get ran out of time for this last case. I know we have 2 cases. I'll just do the end of it. All right. I usually teach in the afternoon. I forgot. Okay. All right. Justice Marshall. Who's Justice Marshall? Anybody heard of this guy before? Sound familiar? This is John Marshall.
Chief Justice
John Marshall. What do we know about him? Marbury versus Madison, that's a good one.
McCulloch versus Maryland.
The most famous, I would say the most famous and influential jurist. Right? Not the first Supreme Court justice, but you know, probably the most important. He really outlines how the court operates. He's writes some of our most important opinions. And I really like the way he writes. You know, he really has kind of a
a nice approach to him. He is often, these are early cases, he usually has very little to no precedent to rely on. So we see somebody really having to carve the law of the country based on kind of going to things like treatises or kind of just feeling like the way things should be. We hear a lot from him of like just the way the world works is a lot of language we hear from Justice Marshall because he has not much else to draw upon. Okay, this case is complicated. It deals with a lot of complicated topics. It has international slave trade, it's got piracy, it's got, you know, the law of nations, and it's pretty confusing, which is why I need some people to role play it for me. Let me figure out. Okay, who's ship number one? Come on down. Come down. Oh, nobody's jumping up? Oh my god, my kids would have been down here. Come here.
Really, Columbia.
All right, she is the good ship Columbia. Good ship Columbia, sailing on the seas, right? What happens to ship Columbia? Anybody know, right? Yeah, setting sail, you know. Just, all right, this leaves Baltimore in 1819. It is registered as a Venezuelan registry. It leaves Baltimore with about 30 to 40 Americans. And then they quickly offshore, hoist a new flag, and change the name of their ship. So just turn your card around. She's now the good ship Arrogante. And she has hoisted the flag of an obscure Latin American state. And she starts looking for slave ships to steal their cargo. All right. Now, ship number two. Okay, who's number two? The Exchange. Here's the Exchange. Where is he from? Rhode Island. What does he have on board? Slaves. He's got like 25 slaves on board. Here you go. Hold those. Keep track of them. Don't lose them. All right. Now, what is Arrogante to do? She captures him, so you can take his slaves and his ship, and you can sit back down. You're captured now. Yeah. See ya. All right. Ship number three. You guys can be helpful. Just come on. Somebody just jump up and run down.
I know. You were eager to do it before.
All right. What are you?
Various Portuguese vessels.
Various Portuguese vessels. All right. So she's going to attack. You have to attack her various Portuguese vessels and take all of her slaves. You have. How many does she have? Anyone see?
She had 95.
She had a big packet. They all go to the Arrogante. Attacked and she confiscates this kit. All right. Now, ship number four. Now we got our case name. This one actually, I believe, is a picture of the ship. The Antelope. Right? Who wants to be the Antelope? All right.
One of the Zachary's.
All right, the Antelope. Now what happens? All right, she's going to attack the Antelope and take... How many ships are on board the Antelope? No, you don't get to leave yet, though. How many ships does she... How many slaves? What is it?
200?
280? But I hear different numbers. 280. Oh, my goodness. All right. It's 160. There's 160 aboard the Antelope. All right, now you just shuffle all your decks together. All right, now together, the Antelope and the Arrogante, now they sail together. You guys are now friends and buddies. And what happens, though, is that the Arrogante wrecks. You guys sail to Brazil, and it's in a wreck. So now you have to give all your slaves to the Antelope. Okay. All right, the hero. Who's going to be the hero? Now they're like, oh, the hero.
You're correct.
I had a good run. You lasted longer this time.
All right. Here's the Dallas. What is, what happens, what, who is the Dallas here? Who is this, what is this ship? A revenue cutter, yeah. What does that mean? Yeah, and also somebody who's out there just kind of looking for people who have broken the law, looking, trying to, so that they can kind of make, get reward money and salvage money and stuff like that. All right, so Dallas is under the leadership of Captain John Jackson here. Captain Jackson here captures the antelope and takes both the ship and the slaves, now totaling 280, to Savannah for adjudication. Whew. And you can sit down back here. You can take them back to your seat with you, or you can stand there for a moment. Okay. All right, now here's the problem. Shuffle up. You got that deck of cards there. Do you remember which ones came from which ship? How are you going to tell which ones came from which ship? You're going to ask the cards, whose ship were you on? Yeah, they might not answer truthfully there. Or no. I was on a various Portuguese vessel. Right? Okay, so this is what comes to shore. We have these ships. We have trying to figure out who owns the ship, but who owns the cargo, and the cargo being a very touchy word here. Thank you. Yeah. All right. Who claimed the cargo? And let's name some of the people who might have claimed this the cargo. Spain. Not quite. We'll keep it on there for a while. They are listed as a claimant as the suit goes forward. Spain, Portugal, who else? The United States is in there. Why is the United States in there? Say it again. Yeah, but who are they representing when they're basing their claim on? Yeah, they're actually representing the captured slaves. Captain Jackson, right? Remember good old Captain Jackson, the hero of our story? What's he basing his claim on? He found the ship and he's like, I'm not sure what's going on here, but it's mine by one of three theories. Either we pretend like we were at war, and I get it because it's a prize of war, or you can say that it's salvage because they were pirates, and I get it because it was salvage. And if they actually are Africans who can go back to Africa, I should still get a reward. He's just like, I'll just throw in every kind of argument I could think of, but I deserve something for this. And then Captain Smith. Who was Captain Smith? He was the captain of the Antelope. He's the one who set sail once upon a time from Colombia, or on the good ship Colombia, right? And he had been with all the changes there. Now, he was the captain throughout. And he says, this is my cargo. It is mine, I deserve it. All right, so the cargo here, the property at issue, is humans, right? And for that reason, we see Justice Marshall having a lot of trouble with this opinion, right? He's really struggling with whether or not we should be thinking about property the same way when the idea of property ownership is mixed up with the idea of liberty. Right? He suggests that we should use a higher standard of evidence, for one thing, when we're talking about liberty interests than we use for just talking about property interests. But what is his holding in this case? What does he, who of our claimants here should prevail, according to Justice Marshall?
The Spanish
name. Why? Right, so the Spanish dude, he says the Spanish have allowed the slave trade. It is still legal there. And we have to respect the laws of Spain, and therefore we are going to give Spain back their property. And we'll see in next class this contrasts a lot with what then happens by the time we get to the Amistad. But notice his language here. He really talks about slave trade as though he hates it. And that his hands are tied. That this is a terrible thing that happens in the world. But because people have allowed slave trade, that it goes actually back to kind of the history of war, people enslaving their prisoners of war, that therefore, there's no way I can say it's illegal.
So notice, this is somebody without law, without precedent, trying to figure out which is to do because of the basis of common law. And he draws upon just this idea of the law of nations. And this is not a written law. This is in just looking at the practices of the countries out there. And he's saying, you know what? All of us have done slavery at some time. And some people still do it. So the fact that we don't do it anymore, and I shouldn't say slavery, I should say slave trade. What is illegal in both of these cases is not the owning of slaves. It is illegal, the capturing of Africans from the kidnapping of them and bringing them to other countries to make them slaves. If your slave was born on American soil, that's A-okay. Anyway, so the slave trade is repugnant just based on practices, but because so many countries still practice it, we cannot declare it to be illegal, and it is not up to us to tell Spain what its law is. So we're going to give Spain back its cargo, even human cargo. However, Spain has to prove which of these cards belong to it. It has to, and so this is why cards actually becomes like a pretty good analogy, because they do not think of this as people. They think of this as abstract objects, and they're just going to figure out what kind of title. You got to show some paperwork to prove which of these slaves actually was owned by you. And the Portuguese, we realized quite quickly that there wasn't actually a Portuguese person. It was just an American pretending to be Portuguese because the slave trade was still legal in Portugal. So they never show up to court and claim there, so those people go through. So at the end, there are some subset that go back to Spain that are owned by the Spanish. And it's only, I don't know what number it was in the end, but it's closer to 30. It's just only the ones that Spain could actually show that they had title to. Smith does get, like, the ship and some other stuff, so he does get some salvage and things like that. All right, so think of that. Keep that in mind, and next time we'll do the Amistad, and we'll show kind of how some of the ideas change, and then I'll finish that.